Even with only a few months to go, the Obama administration appointed a permanent chief information security officer, underscoring the importance of cybersecurity. Based on its survey of security people across government, the nonprofit ISC Squared put together a detailed list of suggested priorities for the federal CISO, Greg Tuhill. I asked about this when I spoke with ISC Squared's North American Managing Director, Dan Waddell.
We knew that at some point this federal CISO was going to be named. So we took the results from that study that we released at CyberSecureGov in May and met with our U.S. Government Advisory Council in June and took that data and really worked towards developing some recommendations that we could present to General Tuhill when he took the role.
Now, when you surveyed the chief information security officers at the agency level, what were their big concerns?
Big concerns, really, there was the top three, that there needs to be a focus not only on educating the cyber workforce, but educating the workforce in cyber. So that was one of the big things that came out of that survey. And also, I think we talk about having the need for accountability. When we talk to these CISOs, it's funny. I almost picture the scene from Jerry Maguire where they're saying, "Help me help you." They really they want to be accountable, but in order to do that, they need the budget, they need the resources, they need the tools in order to really execute their job. So that was certainly a part of it. We also talked a lot about having some training dollars set aside to not only train the cyber workforce, you know, the security engineers, the security administrators, the developers, but also the non-cyber employees. So we talk about the cyber workforce shortage, and we're certainly doing our part to try to solve that. But not everybody's going to be a CISSP. We think that our members are in a great position to improve the awareness and really increase the vigilance across the organization. And so that's really going to be our focus moving forward.
I want to delve into that training and education for the technical workforce, the people that could or maybe not become CISSPs, but the people that are working the controls and levers for cybersecurity. When they come into government, do you get the sense generally that they already have technical skills and that this is a continuing education and training requirement? Or should government be, or is government bringing in people that are smart, but then they need to teach them what they need to know about cyber?
Yeah, I think it's when you bring those folks in, right, it's just the start. So I think that the government is doing a better job at trying to identify the knowledge and the skills and those abilities to not only get them in, but to also make sure that they're sharpening that saw, they're maintaining those skills. So Rodney Peterson and the folks up at NIST, they're developing the National Initiative for Cybersecurity and Education. They're putting this framework together. I think that's really going to help define in a much clearer fashion what those job titles should be, because they really run the gamut, right? It's everything from, you know, kind of that lower level analyst position that's on that keyboard, that's in that security operations center. That's certainly a technical role, but you know, those messages need to be bubbled up to the top. As we saw with OPM, it wasn't so much a technology problem, it was a people problem. The message was not getting up to the top to say, listen, we have a very big problem here, and this is what we need to do to affect change. So it's really, you know, getting that talent in the door, as you said, and also making sure that they're continuing to develop those skills and really focus on the communication part of it. It's almost like that middle translation layer to get the bits and bytes up to the decision makers to affect change.
And with respect to the end users, it seems as if skills in communication on the part of the technical security people were strong, then you would have fewer people maybe clicking on those things that cause work down the hall for the people on the front lines.
Exactly. And again, going back to the point of educating the workforce in cyber, you're always going to have folks that are going to click on something that they shouldn't. So you really need a balance of educating and training just the user population and making sure that they have the tools necessary to not only secure their data, to make it easy. And if you're not going to do that, they're going to find a workaround, whether that's, you know, installing Dropbox or just circumventing the control. You've got to really do that consistently, not just once a year. One of the things that we found in the report was there were some certain feelings within other departments, such as HR, that, you know, cybersecurity wasn't their job. And we really think that, you know, HR is a great vertical to be able to help spread the culture, the positive culture of cybersecurity, because you're talking about bringing in those new hires on day one. And having some sort of orientation program that encompasses cybersecurity training and awareness. Hey, these are the tools that we have in our agency. If you see something, say something. You know, something like that campaign that we hear on the Metro each and every day. That's what we need for our general users in the government.
We're speaking with Dan Waddell. He's managing director for North America at ISC Squared. Also, in your recommendations to General Toohill, you say that he needs to be cognizant of the fact that for the cybersecurity workforce, there are unique HR needs to them that may not apply to the rest of the workforce. What might some of those be?
Yeah, so HR again has a really important role because when you talk about think of it in this aspect. If a security administrator who has all the keys to the kingdom, you know, this person has the passwords, they have the in-depth knowledge of the network, they know where all the weak points are. If for whatever reason that person leaves the agency, guess who's going to be responsible for clicking that button to make sure that access is revoked? That's typically an HR function, right? So as part of an out processing, you know, that needs to happen. And then, of course, automatically IT knows that, you know, all the locks on not only the physical doors, but the logical ones as well are changed, right? So I think HR, you know, a lot of times people don't really fully appreciate the role that human resources has in this. And that's certainly one. And certainly we would be remiss if we did not talk about how the HR is putting those job descriptions up when they're looking for cybersecurity talent. I think we can certainly help HR to make sure that they're crafting those job descriptions so that they're hiring for the right person. Cybersecurity is a very broad field, and so some of these job descriptions need to be very, very specific in terms of what we're asking for as the knowledge and skills and the abilities. So again, yeah, we have to emphasize the role that some of these organizations and verticals in the agencies play, such as HR.
I imagine an agency's job listing could really billboard in some ways whether it's a good place to be for cybersecurity. Just to make an analogy, if you were looking for some other type of office personnel and you said must know how to work a Royal typewriter or something, you'd probably get the idea that maybe this place is a little behind the times. I imagine that same dynamic happens in reality for cybersecurity.
Yeah, I think one of the challenges the government has faced in the past is a lot of times the culture is not conducive to that generation, the millennial generation, if you will. You know, they want to come in, they want to be able to work in a very agile DevOps type of environment, that they want to be able to use their tools and their technologies, and the government obviously has some restrictions, so there has to be a little bit of balance. I know there are agencies like DHS and NSA and certainly in the Pentagon, there's some agencies there that can kind of trump that say, look, it's about the mission, right? I mean, we're talking about protecting our country and doing good, being able to go home at night and saying, I've done my part to help protect my nation, to help protect our critical infrastructure. I think, you know, a lot of times that doesn't come through in a job description on a website. So I think the government can do a little bit better job in really highlighting and emphasizing the mission part of this job, and I think that will attract a whole new wave of applicants.
And also in the recommendations to Toohill, you say that we must address the dissatisfaction among the federal cyber executive ranks and empower them with more authority to make risk-based decisions. Now, that's something they've been talking about for a long time, and of course, NIST has all of the guidance on how to do a risk management approach. What is the inhibitor here?
I think the inhibitor here is we've just been in an environment of continuing resolutions and the threat of sequestration. You've got folks at the C level that their hands are a little bit tied in terms of the budgets. And we were talking about a CR, and really in the budget process, when you talk about continuing resolutions, you're just talking about keeping the lights on. I mean, status quo type of stuff, right? But cybersecurity is such a dynamic, evolving field. There is a new threat out there seemingly every minute, right? And just the way the government is structured right now, it doesn't allow for that type of flexibility and agility when we talk about putting together responses. Now, I know there's some great work done in some of the agencies around here that are starting to embrace more of that agile DevOps environment and getting those acquisition officers that are writing these statements of work and these RFPs to be able to really shrink down the time it takes to build an application from, you know, months and years to you know, we're talking about weeks. I know FedRAMP recently went through something where they really were able to scale down and really deliver a better customer service experience to agencies and cloud service providers. So that's the type of thinking that we need when we talk about service delivery is really being agile and being able to respond to just how fluid cybersecurity and the threats out there each and every day.
Dan, throughout the recommendations, there is the implication or the outright statement that budgeting is often inadequate and dollars are inadequate and the way they approach spending generally in cybersecurity just needs to change. What are some of the specifics that you see are needed?
People are familiar or should be familiar with the CNAPP, the Cybersecurity National Action Plan that was put forth by President Obama earlier this year. Of course, as part of that initiative, Tony Scott has developed a recommendation plan for $3 billion of IT projects, and certainly cybersecurity has a pretty big role in that. I know I've heard recently that Tony Scott is kind of crossing his fingers, hoping that something like that would be approved. We just don't know yet. So certainly, you know, that's something that we continue to look for. As far as the agencies are and how they are dealing with it, you know, certainly DHS is doing their part to provide some shared services to help protect against some of these threats. That, you know, I know that a lot has been talked about Einstein 3A, which is basically their intrusion detection system. I know when we were talking with General Toohill when he was at DHS, you know, he was saying sometime around the OPM breach, I think the numbers for all of the large federal agencies were somewhere around 33% of adoption for Einstein 3A. And when he left, I think that number was now approaching 66%. So they've made some really good progress there, but still we're talking about two-thirds of the federal agencies that have not adopted that shared service model. And so DHS has funding for this. It's certainly an opportunity for the rest of those agencies to really hop on board and to be able to get that help and get that visibility that DHS can kind of provide across the entire spectrum of the .gov domain.
Now, the Einstein 3, the iteration they're on now, as you mentioned, has a December 18th deadline, in theory, at least, for every agency to get onto that. But I don't think they're going to stop developing Einstein as time goes on. How effective is Einstein as a one-size-fits-all, or is it customizable for different agencies? And how does that relate to the entire cyber picture for agency by agency?
Yeah, I think it's a tool in the toolbox, right? I guarantee that it was not designed to be one size fits all. It's certainly a capability that these agencies can leverage, and certainly it allows for some sort of customization in terms of the reporting and things of that nature. I would say that what the main goal for a program such as Einstein was to be able to allow DHS to get some visibility across the entire domain. So, for example, if a particular threat was hitting the Social Security Administration and they were on Einstein 3A, then another agency such as the Internal Revenue Service, if they were on it, then that information can kind of be shared back into those agencies, and they can set up and customize and configure their controls based on that. You really look at Einstein as kind of the traffic cop, being able to direct traffic in and out and kind of raise awareness for things that happen. In fact, I think Dr. Phyllis Schneck used almost like the fireman analogy for putting out the fires and then bringing in the FBI and the Department of Justice to actually have that policing when it actually there's an investigation and there was a threat actor that was identified and they can really go after them. But it's that shared services model that we're starting to move towards that can really afford agencies some commonality and really help to chase down these threats.
Do you feel that shared services could extend as far as, say, network security and network monitoring operations?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when we talk about SOCs, over the years we have seen security operations centers, start at the component level. I know, within Health and Human Services, for example, there was the best practice at NIH and CDC that kind of bubbled up, and they're using that. So there certainly is an opportunity there. And also to be able to leverage some of the existing SOC capabilities within agencies, and then just kind of start to connect the dots. I think another example, or maybe even a better example of a shared services model that could really work would be on the workforce. And we talk about having some sort of cadre of cybersecurity professionals, in a shared services model that kind of rotate across the agencies. I think that would be a great model. Because a lot of times these cybersecurity professionals, they can get bored easy, right? And they don't want to be sitting at the same desk for 10 years. They like to kind of move around and even go back and forth between the public and private sector. I think there's some great opportunity to bring in some of the lessons learned from the private sector if you're having this shared services pool of cyber resources that are kind of on rotation at different agencies. So I'm really excited to see if that idea takes off. I know that it's been talked about both at OPM and some of the other agencies as well.
We're speaking with Dan Waddell, Managing Director for North America at ISC Squared. And I also wanted to ask you about, to follow on what you just said about the integration of private and public sector. Contractors are a big part of the cybersecurity picture also, and many times government and industry are competing for the same people. How can contractors and their capabilities be integrated into what the federal government is doing natively in some way that makes sense for both sides?
Yeah, again, having some sort of cyber corps or cyber cadet to be able to share those resources across the board, I think is really important. Now, obviously, we're starting to see some of that organically. I know when I was a federal government contractor, a lot of my coworkers, kind of rebadged and became federal employees, and certainly the reverse happened as well. One of the things that obviously that we like to see when the government is writing these RFPs and these statements of work is to make sure that they are specifically asking for the folks that are working on these contracts, that are providing cybersecurity skills, that they do have the knowledge, they have the training, the experience, and certainly certifications are a great way to help validate that knowledge and that experience. So something like a CISSP, certainly, that requires 5 years of experience, 4 years if you have a degree. So we're seeing more and more of these contracts written to have some sort of certification tie-in. And then we also look at a retention aspect of this is if organizations within DHS, such as NPPD, they have a cyber pay initiative. They're actually reimbursing their employees and giving bonuses based on the certifications that they have. Would love to see that kind of take off and spread throughout some of the other agencies as well. Because what we found is if an agency invests in that talent, in that cyber workforce, they're more liable to stick around.
ISC Squared is a certification and training organization, so many people that pass through there become expert in different tools and technologies for cybersecurity. But as you move up the management chain in agencies, a common complaint is, I've got so many tools, but they're all telling me different things, all producing lots of data. How can I get this integrated so that I get some kind of a holistic picture of what's really going on with all the tools? How can agencies, through their people, resolve that whole conundrum of many, many tools, all of which are very capable, but when you add them all together, it can be confusing.
It can, and that's where a true cybersecurity expert that has a breadth of knowledge across multiple domains will kind of be able to give you that broader picture. What I have seen based on my personal experience is if you're bringing in those security experts, they can very quickly identify some overlap that you may have in your existing tool set. I know when I was a management consultant, that was one of the value adds that myself as a security professional and some of my team members would have, is that we would go in and say, you can save X amount of money by, you've got five tools that are basically doing the same thing. So not only are you're going to save money, you're going to make your life easier. You're not going to have, instead of having five reports, you're going to have one report. You're kind of, lessening the noise, so to speak, because that's, not just the money aspect and the budget aspect of this in terms of use and overlap, but if you just, again, to your point, Tom, the amount of data that comes out of these tools, right? And you're talking about trying to find a needle in a stack of needles. In the haystack, you need to be able to tune that noise down, and a lot of times these security professionals can make some recommendations to filter and prioritize what's really, really important to you. So, for example, having somebody that's logging into the network on a Sunday morning at 8 a.m. when historically that person really has only been a 9 to 5 Monday through Friday person. Why all of a sudden is this person trying to log in at 8 a.m. on a Sunday morning? That might be an event that's very important to you. But if you have so many tools, you know, shouting at you, it's very hard to hear that one piece of information that could mean, hey, look, I've got an insider threat problem, or hey, I've got somebody that's on the outside that's trying to break in, that's doing something that's an anomaly based on current ops. So again, security professionals can help reduce the noise.
And speaking of shouting, we are in the midst of an election season about to end, and it's unlikely that General Toohill or Tony Scott will be serving after January 20th when the inauguration takes place. It sounds like it's up to that federal standing career workforce that's going to have to carry the momentum on cyber through to the next administration.
Yeah, it absolutely. And I will say, though, give a plug to the deputy CISO, Grant Schneider. So when they did name General Toohill as CISO, they were smart to also give him the deputy, and I think Grant, you know, if and when, you know, General Toohill and Tony Scott do leave, because they are the presidential appointees, they do have that deputy CISO that can provide some sort of stability in terms of a transition. So that, I thought that was having a deputy CISO as well was a fantastic move. But yes, to your point, Tom, we talk about cybersecurity culture in agencies. You know, these are typically the CIOs and the CISOs and the CTOs that are top tier, that have been there, you know, time and time again, to be able to provide that type of stability. And really, they're setting the tone at the top. We talk about cybersecurity culture and the need to get that. They can be a very calming influence in this sea of change.
Dan Waddell is Managing Director for North America for ISC Squared. Find the entire interview along with links to the ISC Squared Workforce Report at federalnewsradio.com/Federal Drive.